Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Is that the end of this case?
How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Start with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all next.
Welcome to episode 133 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We've got three cases again today. First case is Miller versus Thom from the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District. Second case is from the Indiana Court of Appeals, Rubendahl versus Community Hospital of Anderson in Madison County. And the third case is Coquinas versus Kurizwek. I forget how you pronounce that name from the Seventh Circuit. With that, let's turn to our first case, and sorry for butchering that third case name. So transfer based upon venue pursuant to forum nonconvenience did not work for the plaintiff. That is not a typo. So now the plaintiff is trying to get their case reinstated and into St. Clair County via Rule 92. That is the most recent chapter in Miller versus Thom, which was heard for the second time by the Illinois Appellate Court, 4th District, last week. Pat and I thought it might be back when we originally covered it on episodes 49 and 53 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. On the second appeal, the plaintiff relies on Davis versus Maywood to argue that the rejection by the clerk of the Circuit Court of St. Clair County on the original complaint was improper and should be allowed to make the plaintiff's complaint timely. This was an issue that was apparently not raised prior to remand, as it was not addressed in the original oral argument or in the original opinion. A number of cases have addressed the application of this rule, and the rule states, quote, if a document is rejected by the clerk and is therefore untimely, the filing party may seek appropriate relief from the court upon good cause shown, end quote. The good cause here is that they mistakenly did not pay the filing fee and were not advised of that by the clerk until after the statute of limitations had run. And when they tried to refile, the plaintiff clicked the button to file in Sangamon County, not St. Clair. And as we talked about in the first case, they're not necessarily directly below each other. Issues abound regarding the correct standard of which court, Sangamon or St. Clair, is the correct court to decide this issue. It's a mess. Pat, tell us about oral argument.
Thanks, Dan. And so I want to be clear on what rule we're talking about, because when I originally listened to the oral argument, I thought he was saying Supreme Court Rule 92. Supreme Court Rule 92. So what comes Supreme Court Rule 92? And Supreme Court Rule 92 deals with mandatory arbitration. That's not the rule. So I go and I look at the Davis versus Maywood case, and it's Rule 9D is in dog, Section 2. So for those following along at home, you need a scorecard for this one. The numeral 9, parenthesis, the letter D, parenthesis, the number 2, close parenthesis, 9D2. Anyway, so now that we've figured out what rule we're talking about, they apparently didn't raise this rule when the issue arose about the St. Clair County clerk not accepting the original filing. Now, the reason why they were late here was because apparently there had been a voluntary dismissal, and so they had 1 year within which to refile. And when they went to go refile, because originally it was filed in Madison County, it then goes to St. Clair County. They voluntarily dismiss in St. Clair County, and they try to refile, or maybe they voluntarily dismissed in Madison County. Then they went to go file in the proper venue in St. Clair County. They file it, but they don't pay the fee. I don't know how you do that. How you file a complaint and don't pay the fee, how they let you get to the next screen to file the thing. Anyway, they don't find out about the not having paid the fee until after the statute has run. And then when they go to try to refile it, they hit Sangamon, as Dan said. So now it's in the entire wrong venue and late.
And late.
So...
And when fees are not fees paid or not paid,
it's a disaster area. So, from what I could tell, Dan, this was a new set of lawyers on this appeal than the one.
I think so.
Okay, and those may or may not be the lawyers who screwed up the filing in the first place. Who knows? So anyway, these lawyers get creative on remand and they say, "Hold it, this was an error under Rule 9D2." We have good cause. There was an error. You should let us file it timely. We tried to file it timely. We didn't succeed. You know, this is a harsh penalty. Yada, yada. sounds to me like forfeiture. It sounds like what they should have argued from the beginning but didn't. Right. Instead of this cockamamie forum nonconvenience argument they tried to make, the plaintiff tried to argue forum nonconvenience because there was no connection to Sangamon, and they rolled in all the issues about, hey, we made this error. They just should have moved under the rule. As you'll recall, when Illinois went to e-filing and they began to do these things, there was a swath of problems, and a lot of claims didn't get filed timely. And the judges, at least in Cook County, were having to deal with pretty regularly at that time complaints that had been filed but hadn't been accepted, and statutes were being blown, only they weren't blown because they've been filed timely. And I say that as a defense lawyer. It's like, this just isn't fair. If a person files timely, then it's timely. I mean, it is what it is. You know, I would raise the defense, but I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't work, because it also cuts both ways, because there are deadlines for defendants to file counterclaims. You know, counterclaims for contribution have to be filed within 2 years of service and this kind of a thing. So, you know, there are limitations to filing such things. And they, as I say, they do cut both ways. Defendants have to do things timely too. Motions to reconsider, notices of appeal. Everybody could suffer from time frames. Now, the most obvious one, obviously, is statutes of limitations, and it's amongst the, you know, harshest. Although, don't tell me not filing a motion to reconsider or a notice of appeal isn't a harsh penalty for a party that doesn't timely do those things. I mean, their rights are prejudiced too. So we'll see if this works. I really think they have a problem having timely brought this claim. The other problem is that the complaint didn't attach a 622. This is a medical malpractice case, and for those not familiar, a 622 affidavit of merit is required, and this wasn't attached. There was another reason why this wasn't sufficient. The question is whether that 622 is part of the complaint or not, and that's actually it's an issue that came up in another case that got argued last week that we're not going to cover on this episode, but we'll likely cover on the next episode because it got argued late in the week and we'd already figured out what we were going to talk about. But we'll cover. I'll post about that, I think, tomorrow, about what status the 622 affidavit has in the complaint. In that case, it's an insurance coverage case. So preview of coming attractions. I think if they had brought this timely, Dan, they would have had a good argument, and I think they probably would have prevailed. Whether they brought and they would have needed to have brought it in St. Clair instead of running in and filing the complaint like they did. They should have filed the motion in St. Clair and said, "Hey, file the fee. Let us pay the fee and let it be timely. The clerk didn't tell us in time." That would have been the remedy, and I think that would have been successful. But now, all these years later, I think we're 3-4 years later, something like that.
At least
years later, another appeal. Not having raised it, I think they got real problems. And the remedy that they're going to have is going to be a legal malpractice claim, it sounds like. It's they're going to go from having a medical malpractice claim to having a legal malpractice claim, because these people just can't apparently get with professionals that can get the job done. So hopefully their next lawyer does a good job and makes it so maybe they can get a recovery. I don't know if the underlying malpractice claim had any merit. It may or may not have. I have no idea. But the bottom line is that they didn't get their day in court, and I'm not sure they're going to get their day in court in this matter. And I say that, but for the grace of God, go I. Because this mistake that was made could have happened to any of us, to any of our staffs. I'm sure it's electronic filing is great in a lot of ways. Makes things easier. It's more efficient. It's essential in the age, you know, certainly shortly after COVID, and it's become more efficient as we've moved along. The portal system that we have in Cook County is outstanding. It's free. It's better than Pacer ever thought of being. It's really good. I've been one to criticize the clerk up one side and down the other, but the clerk got this one right in Cook County, and it's been essential and made life a lot easier the last 3 years. And I don't know how we could have made it through the pandemic without it. It took a while to get it going, but once it's going, it's been really, really critical. But this here is not the fault of the clerk. This is the fault of the lawyers and their staff, it sounds like. And I don't know if it's going to go the way they want it to. Dan, other thoughts on this case?
Now, Pat, I think you summed it up. You know, but for the grace, I think these are errors. You know, God forbid somebody else did that. You know, the thing you talked about is, like you said, Cook County, there's a lot of angst and things with electronic filing and the vendor that came into town and stuff, but it's turned out to be very good. Other counties don't necessarily use what we do. There was a committee at one point a few years ago to try to figure out if there was a way to get the clerks and processes in every county, and 100-something counties in Illinois. Good luck with that. There's too much, you know, including
you have whether counties with fewer than 10,000 residents, and then you have right. Cook County with over 5 million. I mean,
right.
The two, you're doing apples and oranges. What Cook County needs is not what Fulton County needs.
Right.
They're just two different things. It's not
right.
The fault of Cook, and it's not the fault of Fulton. They just have different. They have just have different things that they need.
And I think, as you said, I think that, you know, if they'd filed in the proper court and mentioned the mistake on filing fees, that was probably correctable. But this is the second time up on appeal. A lot of other issues here. So I think, unfortunately, I think they've got a tough road to hoe to get the relief that they're seeking here.
I agree. And so with that, we'll take our first break and come back with Rubendahl versus Community Hospital of Anderson and Madison County. We're back for segment 2 of episode 133 of the Podium and Panel podcast. And are there viable claims under Indiana law for negligence, intrusion, and public disclosure of private facts where a hospital used unencrypted messages containing private medical information that could be picked up by a ham radio and interpreted by publicly available free software? I did not make that up. That is a thing that has happened. This is the question to be answered when the Indiana Court of Appeals decides Rubendahl versus Community Hospital of Anderson and Madison County. Very helpful in Indiana, they described the case for us. So here we go. The court described the case thusly. The trial court granted summary judgment in favor of the hospital, concluding that the hospital negated the element of publicity necessary for the disclosure claim because the undisputed evidence showed that only one person received Rubendahl's personal information and that damages for loss of privacy as part of the negligence claim were unrecoverable as Rubendahl did not fall within the modified impact rule, which requires a plaintiff to have personally sustained a physical impact in order to recover damages. Rubendahl appeals, arguing that because she alleged publicity per se, the trial court was precluded from granting summary judgment on that basis. She also argues that damages for her negligence-based loss of privacy claim should be exempt from the modified impact rule. So to give you an idea of how she found out about this, a reporter was tipped off to this issue, that the in the ether there were these records. And she intercepted and collected the data, but never published the story. I, like an idiot, went around looking for the story, but there was no story. But she did tell the plaintiff who filed suit. Dan, tell us about this oral argument, which is argued for the plaintiff by this same lawyer that's argued all of these privacy cases against hospitals. We've had a number of them over the time that we've been doing the show, and it's the same lawyer. This is his crusade. So go ahead.
It is, and it's a tough one-man crusade, to be honest, as we'll get into from the oral argument, especially with the rule in Indiana under the McKenzie case from the Supreme Court. The standard there is that information must be communicated in a way that reaches or should reach the public in general, and the big question here was, as you mentioned, Pat, only one person. This reporter was clued in that there's a piece of software on ham radios or shortwave radios. And again, both attorneys, I think, were asked questions by the judge, the panel, and their responses were, you know, we're attorneys, we don't really understand the difference. There was questions about the radio in your car versus in those radio waves versus these ham radio waves. I've got some neighbors that are big ham radio people or former neighbors. You know, it's something that's probably a small sector. You know, there was a discussion by this plaintiff's attorney and advocating this crusader about talking about what the population would have been. There's a 1.5 mile radius where this could be picked up if you have the decoder ring. And they talked about it at one point, a decoder ring or something like that in the thing. There was talk by the advocate for the plaintiff. His analogy was billboards on the street. And then what if there was a decoder ring that you had to decipher, but it talked about somebody's health or other things. And the judges said, well, that is the true public, right? Everybody that goes by those, everybody has, that has working eyes can see those billboards. Like you said here, Pat, it's very different. One of the things that I thought about as I was listening to this argument and I mentioned to you is that several years ago, for those that don't know, the copy machines at offices, whether it's a health provider, law firm, everything else, they have almost like a black box type of thing, a drum or a drive that knows every single scan, every copy, and everything that's sent to that print machine, the copy machines that you rent or lease or own. And so one of the things that came up several years ago, very similar to this, Pat, a reporter from CBS was put on to the fact that there was a warehouse that had all these copiers and printers from health insurance providers, from other types of companies. And I believe it was a sports reporter. And so there was supposedly some major league sports team or some other copiers and printers in this warehouse. And so the reporter knew about these things, went in and paid $100 or $200 for these various copy machines, took one apart and looked at the retention on it. And lo and behold, it had 400,000 medical and health records protected by HIPAA. In that case, the healthcare provider was fined and penalized for, of course, having inappropriately not taken safeguards to protect its data. But here again, we're not even clear from the arguments or from the summary you gave, what exactly. What this person's health condition was, what was reported. But what she was suing for, like you said, was really emotional distress, right? And the embarrassment that this information was broadcast or publicized. And Indiana, maybe other states don't have it, but Indiana has the modified impact rule, like you said. There has to be some physical damage. And the attorney for the appellee in this case was asked specifically what examples of that kind of physical harm. The advocate for plaintiff said that there's really no case that you could find where there would be a situation. And what her response was is that somebody's fighting over a phone and somebody's telling the other person, the person whose information it is, I'm going to broadcast this, I'm going to publish this, and they get into an alteration in the a person whose information is being disclosed gets a black eye. Whether or not, the effectiveness of the decision in McKenzie is that there's no viable cause of action for this invasion of privacy with the modified impact rule is open to question. Let's just say though that the panel did not seem to be buying this crusader's arguments in terms of the billboard, in terms of publicity. They're very, very clear that, look, this guy, number one, you have to have a ham radio or shortwave radio, whatever the situation is. So that's already ferreted it down. And then there was a big discussion about whose burden of proof it was. This is a case that came up on summary judgment, Pat. And the hospital was granted summary judgment because, again, the affidavit from the plaintiff only alluded to this one reporter that you mentioned that didn't even publish the story. So it's questionable, So one person, like you said, we've talked about other cases on here in this arena in Indiana with health information. We had the fellow employee that had obtained information and told his wife, who was the employer of the person. We've had other cases. This standard, the McKenzie standard by the Supreme Court of Indiana, very tough standard, I think, to overcome for someone to be successful in invasion of privacy here. especially again, you know, the panel was asking specifically to the appellant's lawyer, you know, isn't the burden on you? You brought the case, right? That says it's publicity, and all you've come up with is that you only know of one person that has it. His argument in response was that, you know, the burden for a motion for summary judgment, right, is there's no material issue of fact. And it seemed one of the judges asked him, how do you prove in a vacuum if you're the defendant in these cases, right, that nobody else was publicized to? So raises interesting issues. You know, it sounds like, you know, potentially if the hospital, you know, didn't follow procedures or something, you know, the Medicare, Medicaid, and other agencies could potentially find them to have violated some standard under HIPAA or the release of information and not safeguarding it enough. But absent that, I don't see this case. I don't see the crusader in this case under the McKenzie standard and just under the questioning that he faced. I think it's going to be hard for him to be able to convince this panel that there was in fact publicity, and that somehow, and even if you could get there, the second standard is how do you get to the elements of the cause of action, again, with physical injury or anything else. There was nothing alleged in the complaint that cites to any actual physical harm to the plaintiff. And so I think this is going to be a hard case for the plaintiff to prevail on.
A couple of things I want to add. First, that the information that was being broadcast was to doctors' pagers to let right. them know of cancellations or moving of surgeries or other appointments. So that was the information that was being set out and was available on this network. So it, just so people understand what that is. Second of all, the defendants claimed that the reporter who collected this information was guilty of a crime for collecting this information. That seems a bit aggressive, and I'm not sure entirely relevant, but I do recall there's a First Amendment out there, and I think this is the kind of thing that reporters are allowed to do. Third, Dan mentioned the standard. This was a Celotex type motion. We've talked about the standard for summary judgment in Indiana, and that was a big part of the discussion here, is to whether the burden had shifted from the defendant to the plaintiff on the motion. Did they come forward with enough? And the plaintiff couldn't come forward with any information other than that there's one reporter had the information, so that didn't constitute the public. So yep. a couple additional points about this case. Very interesting case. They have modified their procedure, needless to say, the hospital has, so that they aren't doing this anymore. And if that was the goal, then mission accomplished. But I have a hard time believing that anybody's health data was disclosed, much beyond the reporter who didn't disclose it to anybody else other than to tell this one lady, Rubendahl, hey, your information was floating around the ether within a couple miles of the hospital. You might want to do something about that.
Yeah, the only other thing I forgot to mention is that it's very quick, these pager things, like you said. And it was, I think, no more than a minute, you know, that it would be transmitted, or 15 seconds even. So because, again, like you said, it's just pager and information about changed surgeries and schedules and things. So probably not very much information disclosed at all. You know, it may, you know, we don't know exactly what it was, but in the transmission, you'd have to be on that ham radio and have your specific downloaded software to implement the unencrypting of this stuff.
Right. So that brings us to the end of this segment. We'll be back with segment three in a moment, Kokainis versus Kowalczyk. you there?
Yep.
Okay, let me see the check on the recording situation here. Bear with me. I'll be right back.
No problem.
Something happened with the second recording. It has us having four recordings for the second segment.
That's weird.
Very strange. All right. Why don't you bring us into this one? And while you're doing that, I'm going to try to see what's going on here.
Okay.
I'm going to hit. Oh, shoot. It's recording right now.
That's weird.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment three of episode 133 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. In peri delicto par excellence, can a plaintiff state a cause of action for legal malpractice where the defendant lawyers use a handwriting report that was procured by legal malpractice plaintiff, their former client, to argue that their former client's signature was forged on a settlement agreement, the use of which resulted in sanctions in the underlying case, and where the former client ultimately admitted that the signature on the document was hers? That is a question to be answered when the Seventh Circuit decides Coquinas versus Korzak. In case you weren't able to determine what happened from questions, Judge Lefkow's synopsis from the order on the motion to reconsider is here. Coquinas brought this legal malpractice action against her former attorneys following the representation of her in a probate matter in an Illinois state court. Relevant to this motion, Coquinas' complaint alleged that the defendant's use of an expert report that she had obtained and supplied to them caused the state court to issue a sanctions award against her. The other theories against the defendants that survived the motion to dismiss were ultimately voluntarily dismissed by the plaintiff. How much credibility do you think the handwriting expert has in the future? Pat, tell us about oral argument in this short but interesting case.
Thanks, Dan. And so I'll start with full disclosure. The case, the lawyer who represented the defendants, the appellees here, is a lawyer from my former firm. And the lawyer who represented the plaintiffs, appellants in this case, was a lawyer against whom I had a legal malpractice case when I was at that former firm. Now, I don't believe that this case was going on when I was at that firm. But in any event, I know everybody that's in the case, at least the lawyers. And that's how I know the last bit, which is I was confused because there were three counts filed in the complaint, only one of which was dismissed. The other two were not dismissed, and I was trying to understand what the basis was for jurisdiction, because as we all know, the first question the Seventh Circuit wants to figure out is, do we have jurisdiction? I will also say that Judge Lefkow would not have allowed this case to go up if she believed that there was an issue with, you know, finality. As right. It turns out, the other two counts that Judge Lefkow did not dismiss or did not dismiss with prejudice were voluntarily dismissed, which made the dismissal final. And that's how the case got there. That's how there was appellate jurisdiction. On subject matter jurisdiction, which was another question I had, because originally the case was brought in state court. So I wondered what it was doing in federal court. Apparently, there was diversity. Apparently, the lawyers or the plaintiff was in California and the lawyers are here. And the case was filed in federal court, not in state court. So dealing with the jurisdiction as is and as should be the custom whenever we're talking about a Seventh Circuit case, straighten out how the court's going to get to hear this case. I think that there's probably, we didn't hear anything about jurisdiction, and I was wondering why, and those are the answers to that question. So now we come to, so this plaintiff decides, so this there's a release agreement that she signed that she was challenging, say, I didn't sign this. This is a forgery. And she goes and gets a document from our expert handwriting report says, yep, that's not her signature. She gives it to her lawyers and she says to them, don't use this without telling me first. Well, they're lawyers and they got a thing that says my client didn't sign this thing. So they go with it and they submit it and they use it, and they file it, and all hell breaks loose. And it turns out that the plaintiff gets deposed and she says, I don't know how my signature got there. That's not my signature, yada, yada. And there was apparently an opportunity to settle for $30,000 in the fees. And that was rejected. And then ultimately the plaintiff comes clean and the fee award on the sanctions motion is much higher, apparently, than the $30,000. And she then sues her lawyers because why not? And she says, you shouldn't have used the document that I gave you, or the handwriting report that I gave you. What now? So that's why we began with impari delecto par excellence, because this sure seems like she set the wheels in motion for this to happen. Yeah, the lawyers may have made a mistake in not checking with her first, but once she knew she had filed, that this had been filed, and she knew it was false because she knew she'd signed the document, what she ultimately admitted to, why did she pipe up and say, fellas, don't do this? This is a problem. Right. I lied. And the lawyers would have pulled, I can't imagine they would have done anything, but they pulled it back immediately. But that's not what happened. They went all the way and things did not go well. Or as we have said before, hilarity ensued, or not so hilarity ensued. Not a good situation for anybody in this case. So I have a hard time understanding what the claim for legal malpractice is based on here. Yeah. Where they, I couldn't help but cover, but put this case, post about it and cover this case in the show, because it's so outrageous what happened here, and that there is a legal malpractice claim arising out of it. It seems that I don't know what the lawyers are supposed to do. They're given this piece of evidence, what they believe to be a piece of evidence, and why would they believe it was anything other than that, other than legitimate, when their client is telling them they didn't sign it, and, oh, by the way, here's a forgery report that I procured. I do wonder, as Dan said, what the credibility is of that handwriting expert. Anyone looking for a handwriting expert might want to think twice about using this guy. He either is incompetent or he was in on it. Right. Neither of which is very good. I can't think of a third alternative that might be more flattering to the handwriting expert in this case. I say he could have just easily be a she. I don't know. This handwriting expert's got a problem. He's got some splaining to do, as Ricky Ricardo would say. Right. He really does. Dan, what are your thoughts on this case? Just wild.
I agree with you. It's a very wild case, and was trying to sort the same things out. What and why would you bring in a malpractice claim, and what the basis is? I mean, it's your own. You're the one that, you know, got this report from who knows whom, and I just sometimes you scratch your head on why people file litigation and want to expose the conduct that underlies it. But there you go.
Indeed, it's quite strange. But there we are. So that brings us to business interruption for COVID this week. Dan, why don't you tell us about this?
Yeah, two things happened, I think. One was a California court refused summary judgment to an insurer on a COVID case. Again, not a big deal, as we've talked about, very early stages. But last week, a Los Angeles state court refused to grant an Allianz SE unit's motion for summary judgment, and it was returned to a lower court after a pro-policyholder state appeals court ruling. And so we'll see what happens in there. And then the case down in Louisiana that we've been talking about, Cajun County LLC versus certain underwriters at Lloyd's, oral argument was heard last week on that. And as we talked about, Pat, unfortunately, Louisiana, unlike a lot of courts, does not tape or post their hearings online. So if you did not stream it, we won't be able to really assess what that looks like until the opinion comes out.
About Cajun County. You have to watch it live. You can't watch it later. It's kind of bizarre. In any event, so there's that. So it brings us to our prediction: should or go wrong for this week. Miller versus Tom, I think that's going to be affirmed.
Affirmed.
Again.
Again.
And then, yeah. And Rubendahl versus Community Hospital, that's going to get affirmed.
Affirmed.
And Cocainus, that's going to be affirmed.
I think all three are affirmed this week.
Okay, which brings us to our predictions. The one we got, we had a three for this week, Dan. We had one case, and we're counting it for three. We put it into the algorithm, and out plumped a three and up. Out of one.
Yeah, tell us about that. It's Solomons versus Center for Comprehensive Services. Tell us how the algorithm worked and why we hit a triple crown in this one.
Exactly. Yeah, we got a triple. That's true. So then we discussed this case on episode 121. There were three groups of defendants. There was an Indiana defendant who claimed a lack of personal jurisdiction. Court said, you're out, and affirmed that ruling. The court then reversed the dismissal as to two sets of parties. The supervision as to comprehensive services, because they didn't explain to her had evidence that they explained to her the risk of Depakote, or if it would have made any difference. This was a young lady, a very unfortunate young lady, who suffered a traumatic brain injury as a child, had substantial executive function deficits, developed seizure disorder. She was put into a home for similarly situated people. She's on Depakote, which has a black box warning for birth defects, especially spina bifida. She was not put on birth control because she really couldn't manage it. She didn't have the ability to appreciate or manage that situation. And they didn't put her on folate, so folic acid that would have assisted in preventing ameliorating to some extent the risk of spina bifida. Those of you that have had wives or are women who have been pregnant, when the woman gets pregnant, one of the things that she does is she takes folic acid to try to reduce the risk of spinal cord issues, most notably spina bifida. None of that was done. You know what happens next. The young lady is sexually active in the home, even though she was told not to, and she gets pregnant. They bring a claim for wrongful birth, and the defendants defend on the basis that she signed an agreement that exculpated them, and they said, well, no, the agreement doesn't deal with this, and you didn't warn her. And then the other theory, the more esoteric theory, was that because the claim brought by the mother was void, that there was no transferred negligence to the baby who suffered the birth defect. And the court said, no, the transferred negligence claim works. So the two other sets of defendants their dismissal was reversed. So that's how we went 3-0. We said one affirmance and two reversals, and we got that right. So bully for us. After an 0-2 last week, we get a 3-0 this week.
We need it.
On one case. We needed to have a bounce back. So with that, Dan, why don't you tell us about the Corey Webster for the week? We're continuing our string of relying upon him for our rule of the week. Thank God for him. Otherwise, this segment might have to go to the way of the dodo. Thankfully, it hasn't. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, it's always interesting. The Ninth Circuit, our Seventh Circuit doesn't quite operate like this. It doesn't have the number of judges. It doesn't have the kind of geographical diversity, all that. So what he talked about in this week is he said a Ninth Circuit judge's plea to the Supreme Court. You probably know that an off-panel Ninth Circuit judge can call for a vote to rehear a case en banc, which happens often in the Ninth Circuit, more again than Seventh. We don't see that many en banc demands or hearings in the Seventh Circuit. You probably know that if a vote for rehearing fails, an off-panel judge can issue a statement disagreeing with or supporting the denial of rehearing, which is okay. But did you know that an off-panel judge can issue such a statement even if no vote on rehearing was requested? He said last week, Judge Ryan Nelson did just that. His statement was an overt plea for the Supreme Court of the United States to grant cert. He cited a deep split in the circuits. No doubt recognizing his unusual step, Judge Nelson answered the obvious question, so why not call this case en banc? A circuit court will exist. A circuit split will exist whether this court changes its position, meaning we cannot satisfy the overriding need for national uniformity that often justifies en banc review. And then he said a bonus. There was four conjunctions within a span of five words. We didn't take a deep look at that. But just another interesting rule. And the way the Ninth Circuit operates is I think, probably unique of all the 13 circuits.
Four conjunctions or four contractions?
He said four conjunctions, but...
Okay. All right. That's possible.
So, all right, again... I'll look at the order and see what the heck that, how you can even do that.
I think he means contractions.
I think so. I would think
could
so.
Be conjunctions. That'd be interesting.
Conjunction, junction, I guess.
Exactly.
The Schoolhouse Rocks. So exactly. In any event, another interesting rule. And again, it's always fascinating because the Ninth Circuit, like we've said, is just a unique animal. Also, as we've talked about previously on this show, we've covered some Supreme Court cases. The Ninth Circuit is one that, again, that they decide so many cases, very small percentage get to the Supreme Court, but their record in some years is just defeat it. Oh, yeah, they're like the Washington, whatever, the Generals or whatever, that Washington. Played the Harlem Globetrotters. They never seem to be able to win.
And yeah, so, it's I think one year they were 0-27.
I think that's right.
I mean, they made up over a third of the docket.
Yeah.
For the year for the Supreme Court, and they went over.
And
it's stunning.
Well, the thing about it is, it's all kinds of issues and all kinds of statutes and all kind. It's not just on criminal they lose, on civil, on statutory, and
yeah, they lose. You name it,
they lose on everything, and so it's very interesting.
it's a wild situation, and they don't do well. But I think that's moderated somewhat as the Trump appointed a large number
of
judges to the court, which would moderate it. But still, as Dan mentioned, there's 27 judges or so on the Ninth Circuit.
Right.
When they hear en banc, it only involves 11 of them.
Right.
So not even half the court is involved in an en banc review. And so it's 10 and then the chief justice, the chief judge of
right.
the circuit. And so you may end up with a panel en banc that is very, you know, for lack of a better term, Democrat heavy or more left-leaning judges on that. Or you could end up with an en banc panel that's got a bunch of Republican appointees on it,
right.
More right-leaning. Judges and end up with an entirely different result, whereas there are what 11 or 12 active judges on the Seventh Circuit with all of the additions we've had recently, and it's all of them will sit for but until recently there were seven or eight judges on the for an en banc review in the Seventh Circuit. There were barely as many judges as there were as the number of the circuit, so.
Right.
You can. It's a much different flavor in the Ninth Circuit, just based on the size. And there's been talk about splitting it up, about giving some of it to adjoining, doing different things with the Ninth Circuit. But it's been around for a long time, and I don't see that happening anytime soon.
No.
But that's it is a different animal, and so it's always fun to cover it. And thanks to Corey for giving us some fodder for the show. So with that, we'll take our leave. We thank everybody for joining us this week, and we'll see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel Podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel Podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee
a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.